Hello, I'm Scott Winnale, and this is TW Now. Welcome. The Silk Road was an ancient concept used for trade between China and the rest of the known world at the time. Today, China is spearheading an initiative known as the Belt and Road Initiative, or the New Silk Road. This initiative is built on the idea of reestablishing ancient trade routes and international relationships. It uses naval and overland routes to create stronger and longer-lasting trade relationships for China. What is the state of the New Silk Road, and what does it involve? Where will it lead? We actually have an article here for you to take a look at, just giving you an idea of the scope of this project. Napoleon once said that China is a sleeping lion. Let her sleep, for when she wakes, she will shake the world. How do Napoleon's comments relate to China today? And what light does the Bible shed on this newly revived initiative and the nation behind it? Our two returning guests will help answer some of these questions today. We'd like to welcome back Mr. Dexter Wakefield. Mr. Wakefield is a minister and Bible teacher. He's a student of geopolitics and finance and economics. He's also traveled to China in the past and has written about China. Mr. John Meakin, we'd like to welcome you as well. Mr. Meakin is joining us via Skype from England. He's a Bible teacher and a minister as well, and a journalist who also studies in-depth geopolitics. So, gentlemen, again, welcome back to both of you. Thank you for being on the program today, and we are excited with what you have to share. Let me just note to our audience, if you have questions as we go along today, please send them our way and we'll do our best to answer them. And also, as you feel motivated, we encourage you to subscribe, like, or share today's program as well. Well, gentlemen, let's launch in here. We talk about the Silk Road today, the New Silk Road, the Belt and Road Project. What was the original Silk Road? And how did it impact China at that point in time? Mr. Meakin, if you'd like to go ahead and start.
Well, we think of the original Silk Road basically connecting China across Europe and across, but it didn't begin with the Chinese. It actually, this trading route really goes back to the Persians.
Let me just mention, too, we've got an image that we can show our audience.
Yes, picture's worth a thousand words. Here it is. And so you will see actually two elements to it. There's an overland element. China linking Asia across to Europe, coming across the top of India and through Persia. But look at all the sea routes as well. So when we think of the Silk Road, don't think just land, think the oceans as well. And it's obviously a good connection between China in the east and Asia and then across to Europe in the west.
Mr. Wakefield.
I like to think about the Silk Road in terms of unintended consequences sometimes. One of the biggest consequences that the Silk Road ever had was when it was cut off. The Ottoman Turk Empire cut it off from the West in part of their war against Europe in, I guess, 1453 was when that was. And what happened was that it started off the age of discovery. They had to find another way to get to China to get all the goods and the trade that they had. So they started going around the Horn of Africa any way that they could do it, and they started discovering the world that way. There was a smart fellow who said, well, I can get there by going west. We know who he was. Yeah, we did. 1492, he sailed and discovered over there and then turned around and sailed back and said he'd been to India and named them Indians, which we still carry that with us today. So the Silk Road in its use over the centuries was very important, but when it was stopped for a while, it also changed very much and changed the context of the Silk Road and how it was used.
Do either of you recall roughly when the Silk Road began?
The Chinese version of it began 200 to 300 BC, but the 300 BC were the times of the Greeks. The Greeks followed on from the Persians, so the Persian version preceded 300 BC. Goes back that far.
So I think that's a powerful thing to think about as well, that 300 BC to 1453, you got close to 2,000 years that this trade mechanism was in place when it ceased around 1453. Let's move on to another question. As we think about the new Silk Road that is being built today, this Belt and Road project, what do we know about it? What is the state of the Belt and Road, and what is the purpose? Why is China creating this new Silk Road?
Huge reasons. A lot of them are economic. We were talking a little bit earlier. Maybe we can launch into a bit of this now and cover more of it later. But China has a huge exposure in terms of their trade needs with the United States and other parts of the West across the Pacific. But this opens up a huge opportunity for them to have their transportation infrastructure going back towards the East to be able to get to Europe and their markets in that direction. It's another reason why they've been trying to keep the China Sea open, militarizing that and so forth. This is all part of a great plan to establish China as the new hegemon in the world.
Mr. Meakin.
Yeah, there's a lot to say. This is why the subject is so fascinating. All of Dexter said, of course, is absolutely right. But it's all to do with world politics, and it's all to do with empire. And if I could take you back to a quote I think you said at the beginning there, that Napoleon said rather famously that China was like a sleeping lion but was waking up. Waking up from what? Well, we in the West have very little knowledge of China. When we think of empires, we think of the great British Empire, and we say that was the greatest empire the world has ever known. Well, it depends how you measure these things, but I can tell you the biggest empire the world has probably never known is China. And up to 1800, about 1820, 1840, was the Chinese Empire. And then they themselves refer to the 1800s, the 19th century, as a century of humiliation. And due to internal circumstances, which we could talk about if we had the time, the Chinese Empire ceased to be. And so really that happened right through to the end of the Second World War, and then 1949 when Mao Zedong and his revolution started, has begun China awakening. And so the Silk Road is an integral part of the current Chinese leadership's attempts to wake China up and really bring it back to the way it always was, number one in the world as far as empires are concerned.
Just add to that regarding to Mao Zedong, he sort of woke China up and got them out of their dynastic period. However, his policies, economic policies, devastated and strangled the economic energies of the Chinese people for generations, and they are only just now beginning to come out and realizing their potential. It was his system that devastated their what it calls tens of millions of deaths from the failure of their agricultural policies. Their industrial policy was a disaster, and they were pretty well walled off from the Western world. I did have the opportunity to go there in 1984, and when we were there as part of a church delegation going there, we were, once again, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but I was reading the China Daily, and it said that they were having their Great People's Congress, and when all of their representatives of the people of the party had gathered, and that they were doing away with the Marxist economics that they had used for so long, and it was a long list of things that they were doing. I said, this can't happen. This isn't going on. They're doing away with the labor theory of value. That's the underpinning of the Marxist economic system. And I didn't believe a word of what I saw. I thought it was propaganda. So then I got home and read about what they had done. I still have that newspaper at home, all marked up and everything. While the church group was there, they made this move to more of a market economic approach as opposed to the Marxist economic approach. Interesting that that happened. Hmm. It really sort of started there.
Xi Jinping, go ahead. I'll invite you to go ahead and make a comment. I do want to mention, though, our guys in the back, if you could go ahead and bring up the image as well of the new Silk Road, and you might see some similarities between the one that we saw a few minutes ago. Go ahead, Mr. Meakin.
Okay, well, I'll go straight to commenting on the new Silk Road. When you first sent this to me, I looked at this in some astonishment, to be honest, because this puts on paper and in front of you graphically just to see the full extent of all that's going on. Now, let me just choose a couple of things. You see at the bottom of where Saudi Arabia is, where Ethiopia is, I don't know if you've got a pointer, but at the bottom of the Red Sea there, leading to Suez, you've got the Horn of Africa. Right there is a port. If you look at the legend of the ports, there's a square, blue square, to indicate ports which China has in some way control of. The one at Djibouti is also a military base. How about that? So that can be taken into the overall picture. So this, in American basketball terms, this amounts to a full court press of bringing the whole world into China's ambit for all the right reasons, as far as she's concerned, enhancing trade and building up the areas where she is, which is why it's called the belt. It's an industrial development belt, and it consists of roads, it consists of railways, it consists of pipelines for energy, for oil, for gas, and industrial development, manufacturing development. And who's going to be the personnel involved in all this? Who's the personnel involved in Africa and all the marshalling of African natural resources to send back to China? The Chinese are. A million Chinese have been in and around Africa. And so this amounts to a huge, I won't call it an invasion, but you know what I mean. It's a huge influx or an exflux of Chinese to take part in all this. And it's all part of China's ambition to get back to where her status really was, to make her the dominant power, the dominant trading power, not just in Asia, but throughout the world.
I would agree completely with what John is saying. I think there's a carrot and a stick there. You just outlined the carrot. I'll tell you about the stick. There's something that many people don't know, and that's China's external debt. They admit to $2 trillion worth of external debt, over 60% of which is short term. That's money that they owe other people. Other people put that, other agencies put it at more like $3 trillion or more. They must have this trade, and they must have all of this going on, the income, in order to support and sustain that debt. We think of them as having a great deal of foreign reserves. They do, but they also have a great deal of foreign debt. They also have a great deal of internal debt, much of which is very shadowy. It's called shadow banking, and a lot of people really don't understand quite how much that is. It's very opaque. It's hard to figure out what it is. So China could have quite a few vulnerabilities to that. If their trade with the United States, say, should be stopped completely or simply tariffed and was cut down like it's being done now, they need to be able to go back to the East as opposed to the West. So you see them militarily securing the South China Sea, militarizing the Paracel Islands, militarizing the Spratly Islands, so that they can control their trade routes going to the east by sea, and then they're building the ones that you were just illustrating overland, going back to the east. So this is something I think that is essential for them to do. And of course, it presents a huge opportunity as well if they're successful.
I think we can all think nicely and kindly to increase in world trade and rise in standard of living for everybody and developing backward nations in Africa. All these things are very good. I think the problem with the Silk Road is it arouses concerns about motive, about why this is happening, because at the same time all this trading is happening and peaceful development is happening, it is also the military which is being developed at a furious pace. Look at the advances they've made in space technology. So China's goal is to be number one in the world across all categories of state performance by about 2040. But the point that's very important, if I could just hearken back to another icon we think of when we think of China, not just as a sleeping lion. We think of the Great Wall of China. Well, that wall is being constructed even as we speak. Not a physical wall, but an ideological wall. China is quite happy to trade with the rest of the world, quite happy to join in the free market system. We hope that she will move to our values, but she hopes we will move to their values. Mm. She is undermining the Washington, post-World War II Washington consensus. She's not going to become democratic anytime soon. And she is, a bit like a certain gentleman in America, very much for nationalism, not internationalism. And not sharing things out, but being number one, and because of being number one, being able to control the international agenda.
Mr. Meakin, I wanted to come back to something. Xi Jinping, as we've talked about before, has made the observation, in relation to Napoleon's quote, that China is the gentle lion. They're not really ambitious in terms of war or taking over, but they've got this gentle and helpful ambition. Mr. Meakin, you were talking before the program, and you were sharing some statistics in some different areas of their economy and society where they have specific ambitions. And I was wondering if you or Mr. Wakefield could remind us or let the audience know, what are some of those areas where China really has lofty goals in the next 5, 10, 20, 25 years?
Let me just mention on Napoleon's comment and the sleeping lion and Xi Jinping's comment about them being the smiling lion. Well, whether it's a smiling lion or a smiling dragon, they both eat their adversaries. And once they have the power, they will surely use it as strongly as they can. I think Mr. Meakin has some great comments about this. We were talking earlier. I'd like to hear what he has to say.
Okay.
Well, let me just complete the quote, because although this is Napoleon's quote going back to 1817, in 2014, when Xi visited France, he was very concerned about reassuring them. So he went on, he mentioned this quote, "China is a sleeping lion, let her sleep, for when she wakes, she will shake the world." This is what he continued on to say. "Chinese people treasure peace and hope to seek, maintain, and enjoy peace together with other nations in the world. The only problem is that, though that sounds wonderful, it is the hegemon or the nascent or potential hegemon that is saying that. And really, China wants things done according to the way it wants to do things. And look, China is, if she becomes the new hegemon, will do what all hegemons do, and that is they control the agenda. And they would prefer to do it peacefully, but when push comes to shove, as with the British Empire, as with any other empire, then they're going to enforce it by force. And what I think is very worrying is Chinese attitude towards Taiwan and also the South China Sea as evidence of a peaceful approach. They're ours, they say, and any attempt by America to do anything about that, they will repulse with force. So back to what Mr. Wanail said, here are the Chinese goals. By 2025, China expects to be, wants to be, the dominant power in 10 leading technologies. In 2035, that's another 10 years on, it wants to be the innovative leader across all advanced technologies. And in 2049, which is China's centenary going back to 1949 and the new China, it wants to be number one in the world, including military, including space, every area of life, wants to be number one in the world across all of that. The question is, how is she going to get there peacefully? The real question is, how is the challenger to the hegemon, which is China, with the hegemon being America, how is America going to respond to all of this? And there's another comment that I'd like to make, but I think I should hand it back to you for the moment.
Yeah, let me just ask for a quick clarification, Mr. Wakefield. Hegemon, could you just define that operationally for our audience?
That's someone who dominates a particular area in a particular sphere. Right now, the United States is dominant after the fall of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was a hegemon in Asia, around them. Now the United States is said to be the world hegemon.
Okay. So it's this whole role of wanting to be, use a very vernacular term, the top dog, the leader, the respected country in the world or in the region.
I'll just mention that a lion only smiles when its belly's full, when it's satisfied. And I don't think the lion is smiling yet. it's presenting that, but it'll be a lot happier later on, or they hope to be.
Mr. Meakin, I know you've got another comment.
I'm still laughing. I forgot what I was going to say now.
Well, I can take you with little bit. Okay, go ahead.
I'm reading a book, actually, and an article by Harvard political scientist, whose last name is Allison. And he has done a study of 16 situations over the last 500 years where the hegemon is being challenged by the challenger. And out of those 16, most of them, about 12 as I recall, out of the 16, end in war. And his book is called Thucydides' Trap, going all the way back to the time when Athens was challenging Sparta. Now, Sparta rebuffed Athens, but almost destroyed herself in the process. So this is the key question I think we're facing. In a world which is increasingly dominated by China, will the transition, if there be one, from America to China, is that going to be peaceful, or is it going to be violent? And who controls that? It tends to be the one who's being challenged that wants to resist that and fight it off, or is there another way of accommodating it? That's a big question.
Let me ask you, get into the weeds here just a little bit more. What are some of the examples that we have now from China, where China is moving forward with their agenda, and perhaps actions that they are taking or have taken that really cause pause, both from stability perspective, world stability, but also from a threat to sort of the world order?
Well, just mentioned that China has been aggressive militarily in the past, and that's in the China Sea. Many Americans don't know that they did invade the Paracel Islands and killed, I don't know, like 60, 70, 80 Vietnamese who were there. They had two battalions come in and take on a small force of Vietnamese there. They also did the same for the Spratly Islands. They sank some Vietnamese ships in doing all of this.
What was the time sequence?
The 70s for the Paracels, 88, I think, for the Spratlys. That was very shocking, fairly particularly recent, to the Philippines and other areas, that they would behave that aggressively. This was an out-and-out military invasion with Marines moving into and taking over an island. So that really got a lot of people's notice there. So they are serious about securing that extremely important sea gate that goes through the South China Sea and then goes around the Straits of Malacca that Singapore sits on. If I were Singaporeans, I might be a little nervous right now. There's a smiling lion looking around the region there. So I think that has gotten people's attention, plus their great strides that they've been making in military force, high-speed missiles that are lining the coast there to secure that particular area. They now have an aircraft carrier, and there's maybe not fully as operational as one U.S. carrier force, but still, they're building these things very rapidly, so they are serious about being military hegemonic in Asia, that's for sure.
Mr. Meakin,
here's another just another little quote coming from the Chinese. They said this: no country should attempt to dominate regional security affairs or infringe on the legitimate rights and interests of other countries. Well, that's their point of view, and I've written down below, unless it's China. The hegemon dictates the narrative. And in terms of answering your question, what is there to be concerned about? Recently, the head of the American Navy, Admiral Richardson, went over there for discussions. And he came back and said, oh, what a wonderful discussion it was. And we talked about communication and blah, blah, blah. But from the other side of the story, there was just a continual belligerent attack by the Chinese higher military, with a couple of them making the most bellicose noises about how they would enjoy sinking one of the American, or more, of the American aircraft carriers, and which would kill 10,000 people. So why all this military development if you're peaceful? Why are we going for a missile, this hyper missile that can be launched from space, and it would, you know, it would go straight through your carrier and blow it out of the water before you'd either seen it or heard it. So it's the ideological noises in the background, as well as observed events happening on the ground, that gives cause for pause and to ponder about the real nature of what's before our eyes.
Mm-hmm. There have also been nonviolent encounters between U.S. and Chinese ships in the South China Sea. They've come up and, you know, within, I think, 40 meters, 30 or 40 meters, and headed off ships and pushed them around. Very dangerous things. We now actually have, I understand, a hotline with the Chinese. If any of these things get out of hand, that they can communicate with each other to keep it from growing. There have been aircraft encounters where their jets have harassed ours, just like the Russians have in other parts of Europe. So their military, I wonder sometimes, are they completely under control over there? And could they do something that could really set off some nasty action? The two heads of the governments hope to be able to prevent that from happening, but I'm not so sure.
Have either of you read anything on China taking over ports of other nations?
John, you want to?
Well, I think there's a couple of good examples. There's one in Kenya and another one in Sri Lanka, where they were invited to come and invest in those ports. And then in the process of all that happening, it didn't work out very well. The host nation ended up going into lots of debt, and the result of that, Chinese taking over the ports lock, stock, and barrel. And of course, some people will say, well, yes, but just because you take over a port doesn't mean to say you can make it work. Well, I wouldn't bet against that when you see what Xi has managed to do over the past year of what he came to power in 2012, following on from all that Deng and others did. Going back, is it 40 years or something? I think it was 99% of China, its people, were surviving on something like $2 a day. Well, now it's the reverse. Only 1% are on less than or $2 or less per day. Yes, so all of this is an amazing transformation that has taken place. So when it comes to those ports, they will take over those ports. They've invested in Heathrow Airport, would you know? They've invested in nuclear construction capacity just a few miles from where I live at Hinckley in the southwest of England. The tentacles are going everywhere, which is in one sense good, because they're investing and they're helping and they're bringing everything on. But it's always this undercurrent kind of concern and worry in the long term as to the way it may well finally work out.
Let me get to Mr. Wakefield. Before I do that, I'll go ahead and let you make a comment. And then I actually want to shift gears a little bit, and let's talk just a couple of minutes to see if the Bible has anything to say and may give us some insights into what's going on in China with this, even with the New Silk Road Project. Mr. Wakefield, though.
Just add a quick thing to what John said about that. You know, if you have a house but you have very poor credit, you've got to have some money, so you go and get a loan on it. And it's from a lender at a high interest rate, maybe a private lender. Well, that's called loan to own. The guy hopes to foreclose on the house because he's going to make a profit on it. That's kind of what China is at least is being accused of doing in some of these ports. They know that it's not going to work out economically, but they're doing that in order to gain control of a particular area, sort of a big version of loan to own, or at least that's the criticism.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, thoughts about the Bible. What kind of insights does Scripture give us into what may be going on here or where the Silk Road could lead in the future?
Well, in one of the books I've been reading about China, and I really like to lock myself away and stop the world and read all these wonderful books, it begins with a quote. And in that quote it says, the Bible doesn't say anything about China. Well, I suppose in direct terms it doesn't. And it doesn't say much in direct terms about Britain and America, although we have a very strong take on all of that, and in fact it does, and maybe it does about China as well. But certainly in the book of Revelation, in the day of the Lord, just prior to the end of this age and the return of Christ, the Bible talks about an army of 200 million coming from the east and heading for the Middle East. Now, it doesn't take much imagination to ask the question and give an answer as to where they must come from. Because east from there, you're into Asia. And, you know, what nation is there so populous and so capable of doing that? Think of just the logistics of moving an army of 200 million. How do you feed them? How do you transport them? You know, what about their equipment? You know, the logistics of some of this is just out of sight. So we think that the Bible does have some hints, and perhaps even more than that, to say about the future prophetically.
It does mention the kings of the East, and those are the 200 million people. How to get them over? In the past, it has not been possible. Now, the Belt and Road Initiative, all the transportation facilities meant for trade, could be also used for military transportation and invasion. The Euphrates River has to dry up. All of these things happen, and then the kings of the East come over in a great conflict with the West. So the person who said that they are not mentioned, the kings of the East most certainly are, and they are even described.
Gentlemen, we are about out of time. I'd love to continue this conversation, but before we go, I would like you to, each of you, share with our audience perhaps one parting comment or a takeaway that you would like to leave our audience with. And it may or may not relate to the question, is China going to rule the world? Go ahead and leave us with your parting comment, if you would. Mr. Meekin.
Okay. China is a nation of 1.4 billion people. America is a nation of something like 325 million. Their economies are already about on a par, or depending how you look at it, with China coming up fast. Now, how that potential conflict of interest and ideology and just way of doing things is going to be managed is really one of the most key issues of our modern world. We don't really think about it very much in the West, but no understanding of world politics is complete, or even the world military is complete, without including China and taking into account the direction of travel that China is going.
I think China has two vulnerabilities, and I think it is driving a lot of what they're doing. One of them, as I mentioned before, is their debt structure. It's a lot worse than people think, and they must cope with it. And I think the Belt and Road Initiative is part of a large, huge plan to help accomplish and do that. The other, well, you know, they have extraordinary control over their people there. All the electronic advances that they're doing allow them to look into the lives of the people, and the Chinese people have submitted to this so far in an amazing way. Can you imagine that happening to America or some other places? Well, maybe not. So maybe their second vulnerability is going to be freedom, because when they have this Belt and Road Initiative, they want to spread, as they have said, Chinese values along the way. That's a statement that they have made about this. So if they do spread this, will the freedoms that people have and the longing of the human spirit to be free and to be able to express itself, and so for all of the things that we take for granted, that people will begin to get this idea that they need more freedom, and that could also be a major Achilles heel for China's plans.
Thank you, gentlemen, both of you. Thanks for opening our eyes a little bit more. China gets a lot of press, but most of it's the South China Sea and perhaps their economy, but we don't normally get this kind of an insight into really the backbone and the history of what's motivating this massive and ancient country. China is certainly a rising star on the world stage. And in the words of China's leader himself, the sleeping lion is awakening. China has a major world ambition and major goals, economically, militarily, technologically, and politically. While other nations, including the U.S., seem to be focusing far more on internal matters, China seems to be reaching out to fill a power vacuum left by departing world powers like the United States and Britain. China does have ambitions and is moving forward toward them. However, China will not rule the world, as some fear. It will not even be the major future threat to the United States. That role is reserved for another prophesied nation. To find out more about the future of China, Be sure to read or download our insightful article, Is This China's Century? And you can find that at tomorrowsworld.org. To discover more answers to today's big questions, be sure to stay tuned to TW Now. Next week, we plan to discuss how to have a happy marriage. So we'll take a little bit different tack next week. We encourage you to be sure to subscribe, like, or share today's program. And we'll see you again next week.